Welcome to Unframed. I'm your host, Anthea Pokroy, and I'm delighted to welcome my talented co-host for this season, Nkgopeleng Moloi.
I'm excited to be here and to embark on a journey through the intricacies of the South African contemporary art landscape with you and our listeners.
Season 4 offers a more thematic approach than previous seasons, where each episode will examine a different facet of the South African art ecosystem. From the artist studio to the gallery, the curator to the museum, we are delving into the complexities that define our industry.
Join us in considered conversations with established artists and industry experts who will offer insight and inspiration. If you're seeking a more nuanced understanding of the art world, Unframed Season 4 invites you to come with us on this journey through the South African art ecosystem.
This is Unframed, where we create space for dialogue about the contemporary art world in South Africa. In today's episode, we delve into the inner workings of the artist studio, exploring it as both a physical space and a conceptual framework. Joining us are artists Penny Siopis and Nolan Oswald Dennis, each offering unique insights into their artistic practices. Penny, based in Cape Town, has been a pivotal figure in the South African art scene since the 1980s. Her diverse body of work, spanning painting, film, photography, and installation, delve into themes of identity and memory through what she terms the poetics of vulnerability. Nolan, based in Johannesburg, is dedicated to exploring a Black consciousness of space in his paradisciplinary practice. With participation in renowned events like the Berlin, Lagos, and Liverpool Biennales, he interrogates hidden structural conditions through diagrams, models, and installations. In this episode, Penny emphasizes the importance of embracing chaos in the studio as a catalyst for creativity, while Nolan reflects on the transformative impact of his return from the US, highlighting the role of community, cultural encounters, and rituals. Join us for this insightful conversation about the artist studio with Penny Siopis and Nolan Oswald Dennis. So just to begin, Penny, you came to prominence in South Africa, in the South African art scene in the 1980s. You've had a 4-decade-long career and are considered one of the pioneering artists in the South African arts landscape. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey to date?
Gosh, it's such a long and convoluted journey. I always get exhausted before I can even answer the question, but it's basically conventional in some ways, except the time I was living in was not. It made it a question about what art practice was, certainly in the 80s. But I had been studying in Makanda at Rhodes and did my master's there, and then went to Portsmouth Polytechnic, which was in the UK. I got a scholarship there, and which was a very influential experience, although it was an experience that it affected me. It sort of brought on a crisis, basically, about what I thought art was and how I had kind of grown up at Rhodes being considered a good painter. And I was, it was an interesting context because although I was politically active as a student, that politics couldn't really be experienced in the studio. That's how it was. Art practice was sort of seen as this transcendent space which you didn't contaminate with politics. So that was an experience. And I went to Portsmouth, which was completely opposite, and everything was politicized, but not in the politics that I had been sort of associated with, which was really the politics of resistance against apartheid, was very specific. At Portsmouth, it was the idea of art as political more broadly. And it was the first time I really got exposed to a kind of post-colonial practice and a practice which was also very clearly feminist and also was in a very, very different form. There was quite a lot of hostility to painting. There was hardly any painting, except there was some systems painting, which was highly political in a systemic sort of way. And then it was very much about mediated practices, you know, decoding advertising and looking at the sort of ideological construction of art practice itself and its perceptions. And then I came back to Durban after having been exposed to that very, very different world and taught at the Durban Tech for 4 years. And that's when I started making my cake paintings, which was for me actually interesting because I just didn't know where those cake paintings came from. And clearly, I think they came from that complex contradiction between you know, being a painter who sort of loved the sensuality of paint and saw in it a kind of critical dimension. But it was only really when I got to Portsmouth and experienced that kind of dissonance, that, you know, a challenge to my way of thinking, did I think that paint could be used conceptually and differently. And then I went to this beginning of 1984 and was there until the end of 2010. And then I came to UCT. So when I went to FITS, my work changed in some ways, although I was still very devoted to what paint could do, but it changed its focus and became more manifestly critical in a sort of allegorical way, really, at that time.
That's when I met you, Penny, when I studied at FITS in 2003. But yeah, I'm really interested in what you said about the studio doesn't get contaminated by politics, and I'm very interested in us exploring further around this kind of the inside of the studio and how ideas and notions and politics and things come into the studio and infiltrate into the studio, and, you know, the difference between the inside and the outside. So we'll get to that, I'm sure. To Nolan, you started your journey in architecture at WITS, and I actually met you around, I think it was like 2012, 2013, you came to Assemblage and you were kind of in this very transitional stage of having qualified as an architect or having graduated from architecture and wanting to become an artist. And you then went on to study a science master's degree in art, culture and technology at MIT and have made an amazing impression on the kind of global art world in this very, very short time. So yeah, we would just like to know more about your journey into becoming a practicing artist.
I mean, I guess that's my journey.
Maybe not as like physical, you know, the emotional, the mental, the psychological journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think studying like architecture, my architectural training, I think is still like my base. You know, that's like my base kind of mode of seeing, I think. It's like deeply and traumatically ingrained in how I am and who I am and the work I make. But I think around the time we met, Assemblage Days, I had already started working on projects that were somehow ambiguous, whether they were like architectural projects or research projects or art projects, and mostly around Gelegetla. Gelegetla Library was kind of like the place where, even as an architecture student, I first encountered this possibility of a kind of critically engaged, rigorous, socially oriented way of working, and not necessarily way of being an artist or being an architect, because the people who were kind of orbiting around Gelegetla were really from any and every discipline, like librarians and lawyers and musicians. And so it was kind of from that milieu that I started to imagine or understand or become like highly critical of the potential of my architectural training. I remember I would put it something like this, like, I'm not sure what all of this, everything I know is for, because so little of it is used in like the discipline of architecture, like working as an architect. And I think in this moment, the people who were doing, like, to me, the most radical, most inspiring work were doing it under the guise of being artists. So that's the Gelegetla crew, Ryan Malusi, but even a lot of the things that Trinity Sessions were doing. And I think what was really, for me, in that moment, really like eye-opening was how kind of fluidly all of these practices were happening across disciplines, you know, like urban design, community organizing, poster design, like sculpture. You know, there was this kind of extremely broad space of practice that really kind of put the nail in the coffin on my respect for architecture as like as a significant mode of like engaging the world. Of course, that was how I felt at the time, and I feel a little bit differently now, but it was out of that kind of sense of like so much more is possible, and me trying to kind of navigate how to, like, how best find my practice in this space where so much is possible, that I started thinking about art practice very seriously. And I had no way in a sense. Like, I had no way to imagine what being an artist is, except through hanging out with my friends, but that was not the same as having gone to architecture school. And so Assemblage was like this resource. It was like the one place that was actively offering a kind of like a space to learn, a space to understand.
It's quite interesting that in both your responses to Anthea's prompt, that place comes through very strongly, either as a way that defines a moment that made you think about certain things, or that kind of changed how you thought about the questions that you were interested in. And in many ways, this was quite a difficult episode to think through, because we often start with the artist and say, well, you know, tell us about your practice from the thematics. Like, what is your practice about? Whereas now we starting from the other end, where we're saying, how do the spaces where the questions are explored influence what those questions are? So my question to you, and I'll start with you, Penny, is what do you think are the elements that are necessary for a space to function as a studio?
Well, in a way, I have been a strange sort of devotee to the artist studio, to the actual space where you have a physical space. It doesn't always have to be physical in the way we usually understand it, but I'm a very embodied type practitioner. So my theories and my works and my philosophies and everything are also about embodiment and materiality. So I've always liked a studio, physical studio, doesn't matter how big or small it is, because I understand my practice to be literally a physical practice, almost a demonstration of my concerns and my concepts. So I do need a space, usually a floor space, increasingly so, where and a messy space, or a space I can mess, because I'm interested in the kind of idea that mess is not something that you want to necessarily contain or cast aside. Mess is part of the constellation of thinking that I engage with, because it's fundamental that for me that materiality sort of is that thing that often escapes the certainty of signification. So mess is sort of in that domain of expandedness in a slightly different way to what you were saying, Nolan, but it's sort of, it's almost like that's the idea of a sort of social engagement can happen in the studio, in the confines of the studio, because the studio is not pure. It's getting back to that other idea about Rhodes days. The studio is not pure anyway, because it comes with everything else that I bring into it and where it sits in the history of the moment, in the context, spatial context. It's already inscribed with a set of values. It's a space where there's students. It's a space where the history. So already the studio is not neutral. So that's an important part. But the physical space offers me the kind of space of where I can suspend a certain kind of judgment and engage in a way that I like to say sort of follow my nose, because in a sense, it's that kind of openness to contingency and different ways of thinking, which are, of course, as engaged with what's happening outside, you know, literally physically outside, but also outside my brain. And it's sort of, as I say, a place that I enact or demonstrate my practices to myself, but which I have also been able to then move some of those practices to a context which is not my intimate space, but which I could just now mention because it's become quite an important feature for me in a way, which was a project I did at the Maitland Institute, where it was meant to be a residency, and I decided to do it more as an open studio. So basically practice in public, if you like. So what I had always valued so much is the private space or the intimate space, I now opened up and engaged with the public. So it became a public space. So the conflated the kind of experience of making in an intimate space with the experience of making in a wider context. And it wasn't only my making, although it was, the project was these huge paintings, which I sort of made with the glue and ink process that I've been developing over a while, in situ with people from all walks of life, a lot of even school kids, participating in one way or another. They didn't like drop the ink or the glue literally into the painting, although as I was working and as they were sort of participants, they were actively engaged in talking things through. So, you know, it's almost like the strange sense of what a conventional studio would be like. There's paintings. Okay, the paintings are on the floor. There's a process which draws attention to process. That's all it is. But process is not nothing. Process is a concept. So they were involved in seeing this process kind of in an ever-evolving way. And it was on for 3 months. And the people came and went quite often, you know, came back to sort of witness what materiality can do, how material acts, basically. And through the enactments of the material in various forms, you could extrapolate from that a number of social contexts, which were also political contexts. Institutions became very fraught in many ways. People felt they couldn't really speak. And many of the students at UCT also came to Maitland, and we were able to speak through stuff, basically, through how the material acts. Instead of me saying what I'm doing and how I think and what, you know, my process is, the process was speaking, and it became like a third term, you know, a third space, and everybody could comment on what was happening. For instance, we could speak about transformation, literally by focusing on the transformation of this third object in the space. And that was also because the glue and ink process that I've been sort of working on for years now literally is about change. And when I started, you know, on the large canvas on ground, the glue, which is white, it's ordinary wood glue, interacts with the ink that I've sort of dripped onto it and water sprayed onto it. And it's sort of, it becomes transparent as it dries. So the glue is white, and then it changes. It sort of picks up the colors of the ink, but you can't see what's happening because it's white on the surface. So you have to trust the process, and the process then reveals itself, and you see the energy and the change that's been happening sort of under the whiteness of the glue. So for me, there was a lot of scope to talk in talking about quite complex ideas around transparency and opacity, which also political ideas around figure and ground, around performativity. All these questions came up just through the engagement of what material was doing in that context. So I used it as a space where demonstration of a physical process can also open up questions of a social process in an active engagement with whoever was witnessing it. Because what happens often in the studio is, and I certainly felt this with the glue and ink, you make something and you're aware of how material is acting in this embodied way, which from which you can extrapolate a whole lot of critical questions, but you're also aware that it's only you who are witnessing it. And that's strange. And I thought this was really strange because obviously I end up with residues, and some of them went on to exhibition of the process. But when I try to explain why this process was significant to me, other than just being a means to make a painting through chance and unpredictable means, it seemed to be really difficult. But in situ, doing it with everybody else, it became a really accessible way of engaging larger political questions.
I like that kind of separation between the public and intimate space. I mean, I hear of the term all the time, and I think I know what it means, but to think deeply about what it means for a studio to be open versus for a studio to just be a studio. Before we get there, Nolan, what elements are necessary for you to call something a studio?
It's an interesting question. I'd never really had a studio. I'd like had little spaces. And even when I was studying, we had offices, not studios. And I think, I mean, when I look at the work I was producing before, it's quite clearly to me the medium and the scale. And it was all deeply related to this kind of the type of non-studio practice that I had. So I would make drawings because you can roll drawings up. You know, you can like roll them up and you're done. And I was working a lot on like kind of digital works, not necessarily video, but like things that were thought through digitally. So even like the diagrams are things that live on my computer. you know, and they're like kind of scaleless. So this question of the studio is a question that was like explicitly something that I had to kind of contend with. The bigger question in trying to think about what it means to have a studio or what kind of studio I would like, I framed as a question of conditions of practice. Like, what do I need to practice? And the studio was one thing, like an actual physical space to work, to make a mess, you know, but it all happens alongside other things I realize are necessary. And I really like when Penny describes this open studio, and it's something that I'm so like allergic to, the idea of the open studio. And I think for the same reasons, it like promises a lot, but it's also quite brave to open your studio up and to open this process or this moment in the process where things are unclear. The meaning and meaningfulness of what's happening is unsettled. And I found like people coming into that process just unsettles me further. Or I feel like I need to perform some kind of like understanding of myself in that moment, you know, to like invite someone in, this need to kind of open a space, you know, a space of like legibility at a moment where I don't even understand, I can't even read what's happening. And I think what a studio offers me is like privacy. And that privacy is also wrapped up with some ideas of security, like a space to feel safe to do certain things that I don't even understand yet.
I know both of you work in spaces. You've got your studio that you work in Johannesburg and Cape Town respectively, but you do land up having other studios when you are traveling, when you're on residency, when you're collaborating with institutions, potentially using their kind of more public spaces as a studio. But if we go back to your home studio, not your home studio, but your local studio, your regular studio, let's start with Nolan. What do your rituals in your studio look like?
There was a time when I first moved into this building where I was like really serious about like a studio practice and like the rituals. And I wrote like a daily practice, basically. There was this kind of really rigid structure, which I think I needed at the time because I really had no reference for what people do in a studio. But at that time, I was like trying to teach myself or like discover from myself what it is I want the space to be like, what it is I want to do in the space. But now I think it's less programmed. I think I have this kind of spirit, which is funny to think about, like the mess of the studio. I think the studio is a place where things get really messy, but then I have this idea that the studio, everything in the studio should have its place. And if it doesn't have a place, you need to like make a place. But for me, it's really important that things get really messy. And when I'm like done with whatever that was, things have a place to go to. And I think that, yeah, if there's like a constant ritual, it's this ritual of like cleaning up after ourselves. I kind of feel like, and I'm curious to hear Penny's experience, but for me, I feel like a lot of what I do in studio is kind of trying to create conditions to almost like trick myself into working.
Well, that's actually interesting because one of my ways of thinking about how I make, especially the paintings, but not only, is this sort of idea that I create the conditions for something to happen and then it happens. And then I respond and think about where that might go. So there's almost like a call and response thing that happens as a consequence. And the conditions are quite precise, actually. I mean, they might not look that, but they are. When you're in the studio, I mean, if I tried to tidy up, I would spend all my life just doing it because it is a mess. I mean, not only the paintings making mess, but it's a mess that I really understand. It's a certain kind of archive that I really would know under what pile of books and old film drives this thing that I'm looking for is. I'll find it, but nobody else will find it. So there's a sort of spatialization of the studio, which is a studio of messy things, but it's not without order. The rituals are determined also by what I have to do. Like if I have to clear up everything so that I can try out an installation because it has to go like I'm doing now because I've got something happening in Athens, the studio just becomes this crazy space for constant redesign. Analogy would be like my films are really made with constantly reassembling bits and pieces of things. It's like a collage. And I think my studio feels like a collage. And funny enough, you know, Nolan, I think that, you know, from the external perspective of your work, it's that kind of spatialization of what seems to me like entities which are both connected and not connected, sort of finding another bounded field to interact with one another and with the larger sense of what I think you described, which I think is so interesting, is you making visible something around a space which is not necessarily physical in experience, but it gives me the scope to imagine something, even though it's very, very, to my way of working, very controlled and very precise in its mapping. It also opens up a huge world to me when I look at it, and probably not necessarily a relevant world, but still, I think it's great that it opens that space. So it becomes another space, which I suppose is a little bit like how I might see the bounded space of my computer. It's the world in there. Just an observation around how I think the studio could sort of end up being configured like your drawings.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful observation. Definitely resonates. I mean, it's interesting that you look at the work and somehow in parallel to how you'd imagine, like the open but bounded field is like a computer screen. And those works, for me, come out of the time when my studio was my computer screen. And so actually, I think there's this really strong resonance between the space of practice and somehow like the form. I mean, the one thing I've been thinking about as you're talking about your Maitland experience, maybe experiment, the open studio, this question of intimacy, the moment that this is happening around a time where like politically space for discourse is maybe quite difficult. And so this moment in the studio became a way to kind of share space. And I like how you describe it as kind of its own kind of politics, its own kind of like political discourse. And there's something about that that for me is related to the kind of unshareable or the unsayable in any moment, and how artistic practice and maybe even artworks themselves, in my understanding, it's not that they like disclose or share the unshareable, but they create a kind of space where the unshareable is not disclosed, but like shareable in the sense that you can inhabit this thing which is unsayable. You can kind of co-inhabit something without disclosing the nature or quality or scale of whatever that unsayable thing is in that moment.
Penny, I wanted to ask, because you mentioned your video works in particular. So on a practical level, how would you engage making a video work versus the process you've described so beautifully around how we think of material in terms of the work you do with painting? But maybe you can speak to the digital end a little bit.
What I really do, I'll just describe the process because that's always quite specific, is I buy reels of 8mm and 16mm film, but the process of buying them is chance-related or chance-driven and also very contingent. So just to backtrack, when I made my first film that is of this form, which is basically a montage of text, filmic image, and sound, preferably music, it was in 1997 with Okwi in Wezo's Biennale at Johannesburg, second Johannesburg Biennale. And I made that work from my mother's old home movies, from the reels. And at that time, I had to put the reels onto video because digital wasn't operative in the way it is now. But in 2010, I made another work. I made some in between, but 2010, I did Obscure White Messenger, which was made from not my mother's home movies, but from strangers that I just find literally in flea markets and charity shops. And, you know, it's really random. But the act of finding them has become for me quite important because people say, why don't you just go online and buy them, you know, and use the material? But it's not about the imagery only. It's about the actual physicality of the film and the strangeness that happens when you find it. And then you find them saying that the market's in Millerton and I don't know what's on this thing. I just buy them sight unseen. And I take them to this is a, you know, another one of my contacts over the road near Kloof Street is Noel Solomon, who then transfers it onto digital for me. And then I edit from the digital. But what's extraordinary, when I get them digitized, I open the drive and they are these extraordinary films filmed by other people. And in a way, it's a strange way of communicating, I don't know if you'd say that, with people who I don't know, but whose lives have existed in some way. Now, they're not necessarily all in South Africa, so they're kind of migrant images. And then I cut different sequences from these random films, and I make a new story out of them. So I don't shoot anything myself. It's all already in the world, and all I do is collage them in a different way. And the story is presented as text, which sort of has the appearance of subtitles. So there's obviously a sense that it might be about translation or whatever it is, but what the reality of engaging with the film is that as a viewer, you read it. So you have to read the story. There's no voiceover or anything.
Nolan, if we look at kind of Penny's process, and she works with video, which this old kind of film is quite material, and obviously her painting practice in contrast, and Penny kind of picked up on this contrast of working and process and materiality, I suppose, of your output of your work. I'd like to ask you a little bit about, you know, the objects, the materials that you use, and how it's quite an unconventional or non-traditional art making practice, like paint, oil on canvas. Can you tell us a little bit about the objects you choose to work with, you know, what they represent, what actually goes into creating an installation, and what the meaning of those moments of materiality are to you?
Most of my work starts out with a very specific interest, usually like a discipline. Actually, it often starts with like a phrase. Maybe the most constant phrase is like a black consciousness of space. But I don't know what this means, you know? Or recently, performing geology. This is like a phrase that I'm trying to think through. And then I guess the objects, the drawings, they kind of emerge out of trying to find ways to think about this. So they're not like, they're conceptual works in a way, but they're not conceptual works in the sense that they're functioning on this kind of plane of pure language or anything like that, or like pure dematerialization of concept. I'm much more interested in thinking about them as devices or as tools. And there's this kind of ambiguity, I think, about like a tool that I'm really, really interested in. And so the works themselves, the object in particular, come out of trying to find a form that is like, I don't call them sculptures, I call them models. And I think about their construction in the way that I would think about making a model. In some ways, it's like a really, maybe it's an architectural attitude. And in some ways, it's like the real, like lowest, like the lowest form of conceptual thinking. Like I think traditional art practice constructs meaning in extremely sophisticated and poetic ways. It's like when Penny talks about collage as a mode that is like present in almost every part of your practice, from how you occupy space in the studio to editing. This for me is like, you know, like the most satisfying and sophisticated way to deal with material and conceptuality. And model making is like the most base level of doing that, because you're constructing things in a really contrived way. And so all of these objects for me, I try to think of them as models. I try to think of them as like having very particular relations. You say like the material has a particular history, particular geography, and I'm mobilizing that geography and the construction of this. I think of them as components, really. It's like these stands, these globes, these like calabash boards, but how they enter the studio. I mean, the last time I made a whole like bunch of physical works was maybe 2 years ago. And that like process of constructing, I mean, there's always kind of unexpected or unplanned resonances, but they often are about seeing something that connects to the research that I've been doing. But for example, my studio is in Ferreira's Dorp. My commute to studio, now I drive more, which is a bit of a nightmare. But I used to catch the train to Park Station and then walk through town. And that's kind of like a material library. You know, you like walk past these shops and you see every single thing. Very close to the studio is Diagonal Street, which is one of Johannesburg's kind of traditional healers markets, where you buy all of these paraphernalia and medicinal plants and medicinal objects, the ritual objects. And that part, you know, daily commute, is where I came across these big gourds with the kauri shell netting. So in this moment of like walking past this market, these two, like the object and the idea kind of meet, and then the possibility of like the model, this as like a component in the model, became like, yeah, that's kind of, I would say, where it comes from. It's this weird, there's always a huge element of chance and of encounter, but within a framework of intention. Like I'm really trying to think about how to, at least with that series of like globe works, like how to take the kind of Western colonial tradition of navigation and a world, like making images of the world, and within, and Penny earlier spoke about like the boundary in this box, like within the kind of bounds of the artwork. So for me, I would say that like within the bounds of this tradition, within the bounds of this object, what kind of intervention can I make that can kind of unbind it, you know, that can kind of expand the horizon of what this image or image device can offer us.
Yeah, and I love this space of where you walk into your studio or you're in this space coming from one place to the next. I really do believe one's got a kind of strange kind of alert to things you see, you come upon. I mean, I know you had a precise focus, but I think the openness that I'm kind of interested in is what happens sort of by mistake almost. You know, you're walking along and something strikes you and you make a connection. And it's something that I've also done all my life, and it just makes me think of a project that's actually on display now at A4, which is called Will, which is about 700 objects that I've accumulated since 1997, when the work first started. And they've all, each one of them, have been bequeathed to somebody in the world. And this work only comes to be a work when I die. And then all those objects get dispersed. And they're not, some of them are not very precious. Some of them are historically interesting, but some of them I bought in Diagonal Street.
So we've spoken a lot about how, you know, ideas and people and thoughts and objects come from the outside into the studio. I'm curious about the transformation of what happens to the work in the studio and how it kind of goes into the outside world, into exhibition spaces. And what is that kind of like going from that intimate space into a very public space? How does that feel to you? And how do you think that the work is transformed in that process?
Yeah, I mean, the one framework that I find useful to think about this is to think about that period in the studio as like this really unclear moment where nothing is certain, everything is open, and even the significance of what you do is not clear. And the gallery or the public, whatever the kind of moment of like public encounter, like the next step in the production of the work or the, you know, that's kind of where the, for me at least, the significance or the meaning or the meaningfulness of the work reveals itself. Before then, I can only really know why I can't even know why I, but I can only really know that I am compelled to do this. This feels like an appropriate response to whatever I'm thinking about. But whether that response is ultimately like, in, I mean, it's weird to say like effective, but maybe appropriate is a word I would use, you know, like whether that was in an appropriate way to try and think through this is only for me like apparent in the moments of public encounter. And then we realize that actually every time there's a public encounter, like that meaning is not stable. You know, every time there's a public encounter, it shifts, it must shift. And so that, like, yeah, I mean, I'd say that's one framework that I think about a lot. And then the other is maybe that, like, for a lot of my work for a long time, I would only see it in public. It would exist maybe as like a set of ideas, some computer files, and I'd maybe see parts of it in fragments, but to see the work as a whole would only ever happen when it's installed somewhere in public. And so the, like, this distinction between the studio and the exhibition space has never really felt so decisive for me, because the exhibition space is really an extension of the studio. I mean, I really would love to, like, take some old works back and rework them. And yeah, the art world loves things to be finished. But for it to return to the studio is actually quite a radical, like, thinking of, like, the politics in the material, in the paint, in the canvas. There is something about that that is really exciting for me. But I don't have opportunity to do that. But maybe I'm going to fight for that now.
Penny, you spoke a lot about the Maitland exhibition, which was really around this kind of public viewing in real time of the process and of the making. When you're creating works in your studio in a more kind of intimate environment, and then they go out into the world, is there some kind of consideration or concern in terms of the way that this is viewed by the public?
I'm quite sensitive to the way everything in art is viewed. I mean, and this even amounts to, like, how images are reproduced in books. And I really resist the way that they're often just looked at as illustrations of a theoretical, you know, text or something. So I'm always for engaging the artwork itself as an exploration, a critical, theoretical, philosophical entity. It doesn't always have to have the writing around it. Of course, that's how we engage art very often, through the context, the discursive context. For instance, if I go to a gallery and I find that, especially with my video work, that there's basically the video's projection image is cut in half or something because it suits the screen, or it's on a 16:9 when it should be 3:4 or something. So those things are also about how works get presented in the public spaces and disseminated. So I'm quite careful about that, and feel that I should be even more careful. With my paintings, I think paintings just go sit in the world in some way or another. You know, they're quite hardy things, unless somebody literally cuts them in half or something, you know. I'm not very precious about them. What I find interesting is when I sort of recall them, so to speak, and rework them, very aware of the kind of viewpoint of many people, that, as you say, there's something very distinctive about that moment in which they were painted. You know, the material body is sort of being, material surface is somehow, and the method of painting is somehow, there's some integrity to it that should be kept, you know. So I'm with that to some degree. At the same time, I think that sort of goes very much into the sort of fetishization of art, you know, that the hand was touched in 1997 in this particular way, and, you know, and everybody must be in awe of that. That doesn't bother me much. And I say that meaning it doesn't bother me for all my works. There's certain works that I feel that is important for. And so I make those distinctions as I go along. And I'm, you know, I'm often called on my contradictions. Say, oh, but you said this and you mean that and now this and whatever. That's fine. That's the process in which I'm working. It's my process of thinking. I'm not really into a kind of purist view of the world. I think also the not working on or working on them again, recording them and working on them, is also related to another sense that I have of not necessarily putting extra things into the world. I've got them there. They're around. They're a surface. They've already got a history. Why not keep working on them? And it's also a little bit consistent with my idea of my practice more broadly, that I'm always kind of working on the same painting, always working on the same sort of idea anyway. It doesn't look like that because it looks like I'm constantly shifting. But in fact, it isn't. There's some very basic things that I'm concerned with, which is, you know, paradoxical, obviously, because change is one of them. You can't say that you're consistently interested in change, but I think I have been, you know, from the early cake paintings that change because they've aged. I mean, I don't want to go and fix up those paintings. They need to age. They need to crack. They need to, you know, I wouldn't recall them and repaint them because they wouldn't have the same congruence with what I'm interested in now. They are who they are. They need to age, and they need to just age in that way. I know some people who have got their cake paintings restored, which is great, and they look young again. But it's what you need in the moment, I think, and what the concerns are with, I think you mentioned it, Nolan, when you said it's about something very particular, you know, it's this particular object, this specific thing. Everything has a kind of its own sense of integrity.
It's interesting to me that the object and materiality have kind of come up in different ways throughout this conversation. I was reading Marina Verschmidt, who kind of writes about speculation and the speculative. And she notes that she's been thinking about how to shift discourse away from materiality versus immateriality towards an analysis of speculation versus non-speculative, I guess. And of course, these are imprecise terms and they shift and they change. But my question to you was going to be kind of maybe a provocation to say, how do you think about the immaterial in the work, even though you end up with, like, in your case, these objects in the Will Project, Penny, or with you, Nolan, you end up with these globes or these diagrams. What does this kind of contrast evoke in you, this like materiality conversation, as she frames it?
Well, I think the material embodies the immaterial, if you like. I mean, I think materiality for me is also a way of thinking about energies that you can't necessarily see in the obvious way. I mean, you know, unless you went to put them under a microscope or something, you can see lots of energies moving around. I think it's difficult to show the immaterial. I think as I'm speaking to you now, I think that's material. I don't think it's immaterial. Discourse, you know, bodies engaged, conversations, energies between people. I think that's all material. And my thoughts are material. I actually think I'm a material thinker. I think it's not about necessarily the physical object. A physical object for me is just one way of us all agreeing, as looking at something, that there's something in space and we'll call it a bottle or whatever. And then we can extrapolate from that all sorts of things. So it's sort of a point of contact, the object. But the thing that really interests me is the kind of, I mean, some people will say the spiritual or the words, discourse, conversations. For me, it's all embedded in, it's all stuff in a sense. It's just that some stuff finds a sort of shape and we've called it a name and it's got a history of, it's got a biography, basically. And maybe it's the material, it's not about it being a stand-in either, because I don't think something stands in that way. I think it's just that it is recognizable as a means or a nexus through which we can engage, if you like, the immaterial. But I also agree with you. I don't like these distinctions. And I think I don't like the distinction between subject and object or figure and ground or any of those things. I think that the task of many artists, as I see, is that they're constantly dislodging those sort of binaries and these ways of thinking. And speculation or the speculative is actually, I wouldn't even call it the space between, because it's not between. You're still then getting polarized situations. The desire is not to have the binaries and not to have the split between subject and object, material and immaterial. But in reality, it's through the material, or which I, as I say, I understand also as conversation and voice and speaking, and that one can make the contact. And it's the contact that interests me, or the sharing. But I think with Will, for instance, that Will, those objects, they're objects, and they will have to go to some other part of the world in their process of becoming something. And I can't see what's going to happen with them. That doesn't mean that they're not actually traveling to, I don't know, Senegal or something, one of them, and will then be in somebody else's world. So it's a little bit like what you're saying, that there's the immaterial that has a life that I might not be able to objectively, empirically demonstrate.
I agree. I think completely. I think, like material in this binary has a kind of, it has like a cultural history, you know, mm-hmm. and it has, there's like that kind of power written into where the cut between the material and the immaterial is made. And I guess, like, you know, the material always has these kind of connotations of like because it's concrete, it's like trustworthy, it's permanent, it's maybe fact, you know, it's factual. It belongs to the realm of like, of physics, basically, you know, it's like reducible to certain domains, science. And then from, like, then it becomes, it enters this kind of social life where it encounters the immaterial. But in and of itself, like the material is beyond us. Like fields that I'm interested in, a lot of them like science fields, physics, geology, and you realize that actually the kind of concreteness of what we call the material is produced through immaterial means. It's like a kind of a reflection of a certain social, political, historical attitude, and things like flow in and out of materiality. Let's say like normative materiality all the time. And because of that, it's like, for me at least, and from like the orientation of my practice, it's a clue that this distinction between the material and the immaterial is a kind of like makeshift distinction. And like in my understanding, I would say like speculation has to do with the possible, and the possible is like highly contested, highly policed. And so things that are like move from like possibility into probability into actuality are things that have either navigated that kind of maze of power or have been granted existence, like have been granted perception really through like the interests of a prevailing cultural power. But I think given where we are from and who we are and who I am and the orientation of my practice, I'm really interested in the things that are not granted that power, or the ways of moving through the world which are in some ways like impossible. You know, like if speculation is like the face of contest over the possible, what are the things that are just outside of that? What are the like ways of being, ways of seeing that just like somehow fall outside of the authority of power, which of course nothing does, but something seems to. And I think it's that seeming to that's really, for me, feels like a space where there's some place of practice. But of course, the immaterial is also where I think like things survive, things that are like almost impossible to be understood materially, because the relationship between certain practices and ideas and histories and lived reality, because that relationship is so fraught, because there's so much tension in that, and the immaterial is where those ideas and those practices can continue. But I think that distinction between material and materiality has very little to do with the physicality. I think any time we try to think through these like dualities, binaries, the place that I always find myself feeling more drawn to is the space outside of that. What's like the purely non-material, non-immaterial, you know, like what is that kind of thing? And then, yeah, maybe find a way back towards questioning this binary.
What you were saying earlier on about your space or your exploration of the idea of space, Nolan, was very much like the, I don't know how you phrased it again, but it's the kind of space of, what did you call it? Like a black consciousness space?
A black consciousness of space.
Yeah, a black consciousness of space. So for me, that is like what I would sense as the kind of idea of an immaterial, what seems to be immaterial, because it's about its consciousness. So it's not sort of demonstrable in the kind of patterns of power relation that there are at the moment in terms of just the way discourses are written. And I think that that's part of where art works, because I think art is, especially sort of media art, a kind of speculative process, media meaning non-manifestly material practices. So the spaces of thought, it's something that I'm interested in terms of materiality, but most people wouldn't think that that's what materiality does. Because I think materiality, if you look at what is, say, your phone, you know, we don't necessarily think of this, but we're touching it all the time and we're having our energies produce something in this object, which is also social media, which is also contact, which is also all forms of other materialities, which I call materialities. which are not object-based, and they're not necessarily position-based in discourse either. I mean, I know this sounds incredibly abstract, but it's that space where it's the space of potential, in my view, which is not really a space which is stable. In my view, that's positive. It is a space. And since we're getting to the studio, I mean, an imagined space, a speculative space, we call it a space. Rightly so, I think.
That's a great place to end, I think. But wow, I've really enjoyed this dialogue between the two of you. Thank you for being so kind of dynamic between the two of you. This has been so great and so interesting. We were so interested in bringing the two of you together because of coming from such different spaces and looking at the similarities and differences has been incredibly insightful. So thank you both. We are very grateful for having you here, and we're excited for you guys to continue a conversation in real life.
That would be lovely to see you and to engage more, you know, not necessarily only to continue the conversation, but I really am a great admirer of your work.
Thank you very much as well. Thanks for putting this together. It's been a real privilege to get some insight into Penny's mind.
A special thank you to our wonderful guests for contributing their insights and valuable time to our discussion. Your engagements have added so much depth to our understanding of this industry. Our sincere gratitude goes out to you, our dear listeners, for engaging with this conversation. If today's episode resonated with you, we encourage you to subscribe to Unframed on your podcast app and express your support by leaving a review or follow and engage with us on social media. Your ongoing encouragement is integral to the continued success of Unframed. Season 4 of Unframed was made possible by the generous support of the National Arts Council. Thank you to our dedicated team, our project manager, Neve Walsh-Foster, our sound engineers, This Audio is Visual and The Audio Room, social media strategist, Alex Carolus, and graphic designer, Sanele Balintaba. This brings another episode of Unframed to a close. Thank you for being part of our community.